session number 19661, Real Fool.
Well, it's Real Fool.
It wasn't a particularly salubrious place, in fact. It was exactly what you'd expect of a holding unit. People were brought in. They were looked after somewhat basically. No real medical side, except there was an intensive care place, but if you were like me, no real medical side to it at all. And you were labelled ready for shipping out to wherever you're going for permanent hospital care. I remember I couldn't shave myself because of my wounds. I had one hand I could use, but I couldn't shave properly. I remember an old Korean cleaner who came round the big ward I was in, sweeping the floor. He made an offer, in what language I'm not quite sure, that he would shave me, and he shaved me for a couple of mornings while I was there. So I was looked after in that way. And I do remember that Thanksgiving Day occurred while I was there, because everything stopped for Thanksgiving Day. And we were all told we could get out of bed, go down to the dining room, and have Thanksgiving dinner, which we did. Turkey, cranberry sauce, etc., etc., etc. And afterwards we had a film, which I think was Alice Through the Looking Glass. Always to sort of associate the two things. And I spent my 2, 3, 4 days there with a label figuratively tied round my neck, saying where I was going. And one day they came and put me in an ambulance. I was taken off to Seoul Airport, where I had another nationality involved. I was put onto Royal Australian Air Force Dakota Flying Ambulance and flown out to Kure in Japan, which was the Commonwealth base, a large ex-Japanese naval base, in fact, where they had established the Commonwealth Military Hospital. And I went into the Commonwealth Military Hospital, which was a very, as I remember it, magnificent pre-war hospital building with typical pre-war hospital wards holding about 30 beds, great long airy wards, and staffed by a mixture of New Zealand, Australian, Canadian and British nursing sisters and doctors. I think the chief surgeon, for instance, was a Canadian, the hospital commander was a Brit, and so on. They were distributed around the Commonwealth. And that was our place of recovery. I don't know how many people were in there, but it was a big hospital. I saw Christmas there and New Year. And after New Year, I went out to the Rehabilitation Centre, which was run by the Army Physical Training Corps. And all your nice soft life of the hospital and so on and so on, and latterly in the hospital going out to the officers' club for afternoon tea when one was allowed out for the afternoon, all quickly came to an end when you got into the hands of the Army Physical Training Corps, who were getting you fit to go back to Korea again. And in fact, between the two, one did have a rather nice week when one went off to an island just off in the inland sea, just near Kure, called Miyajima, where one had a week in a hotel, which was again taken over by the army, as a sort of stepping stone from hospital to rehabilitation. It was a hotel built for Prince of Wales, subsequently Edward VIII, when he was doing his Far East tour, one gathered, and it was very, very pleasant on this little island. But I say that was just a passing thing, and one went off and got fit again. And then, having done your course and been declared fit, presumably by the APTC, one went into the reinforcement pool in Kure, where there was a a British camp which processed reinforcements and so on. And one went back there. I stayed there precisely 24 hours. And I was put on a ship. It was an ammunition ship, in fact, which plied between Kure and Pusan. And I was put on the ship back to Pusan, onto a train in Pusan, and back up to the battalion, where I must have arrived sometime in January, when it was, of course, extremely cold.
Did you return to the same job?
I initially returned to the same job, yes. Went back to my old platoon, which had changed somewhat, but the old mob was still there, or some of them were, who seemed quite glad to see me back. I brought a bottle to celebrate my return, and I climbed into the trenches that they were in at the time, and I put the bottle on the parapet while I took my pack off and had a word with the platoon sergeant and so on. And as we were chatting, there was a whiz over our heads and a bang as a shell landed just behind us. A piece of shrapnel came over and broke the bottle. And I said, "Where was that shell from?" And somebody said, "It came from behind us." I said, "Thank you very much for welcoming me back." This time it was the New Zealand Field Regiment, who somehow had managed to aim a shell in my direction. So I knew them quite well. So I sent them a message saying that they owed me a bottle of whiskey, which did, given their due, duly arrive. So that was my welcome back to the battalion.
Were they more or less in the same place that you'd left them?
They were roughly in the same place, in the same area. Battalions had moved around, but they were in the same area. In fact, we'd got ourselves into a fairly static war which hardly moved from then on until the armistice. There was quite a lot, even after we left, subsequently the famous battles on the Hook with the Duke of Wellington, the Black Watch and so on, but nobody really gained any ground or lost any ground. There was some fairly bloody fighting went on, but it was all, I don't know what you'd call it, irritation more than anything else, I think, on both sides. It was shortly after that that we were in A Company were given a fairly nasty position, actually, which again was one of these stuck out rather like sore thumb. There was a main line which was being held by 28th Brigade, and then there was a spur ran out for quite a long way. It must have been about a quarter of a mile, with a pimple on the end, which we'd inherited as part of the battalion position, but didn't really seem to be of any value. But it was a company location, and we were given this to hold. This must have been in, by then we must be talking about April. It was beginning to get a bit warmer. And we were given this particular feature to look after. In fact, saying it's going to get a bit warmer, I haven't mentioned the cold. I sort of rather glossed over that, because the winters in Korea were, by any standards, extremely cold. And just as an indication of how cold they were, a couple of examples. One is motor transport. Obviously, you had antifreeze in the engines. In fact, you had 100% antifreeze in the engines. But it was so cold that that wasn't really of any great value. And when vehicles were parked at night, you had a vehicle sentry whose sole job was to go around starting each vehicle every half hour to warm up the antifreeze, keep it circulating. If you left them overnight, the engines would freeze solid. So that was the motor transport. The Vickers machine guns have quite a complicated firing mechanism, thing called the lock, which is about the size of a packet of cigarettes or a couple of packets of cigarettes, which extracts the rounds from the belt of ammunition and feeds it into the gun, takes out the empty case and ejects it. And it is a very old-fashioned, complicated, beautifully made piece of mechanism, but it can be removed from the gun. And the gunners very quickly found that they had to remove this lock from the gun when the gun wasn't in use in the winter, because if they didn't, it froze solid. So gunners walked around with the lock in their pocket, and when they wanted to fire the gun, they took the lock out of the pocket, put it in the gun and fired the gun, took it out of the gun, put it back in the pocket. Any other weapons were always dry. They were never oiled, because oil froze, so you couldn't have oil on your weapon when it was cold. Another example was that a mug of tea, really hot tea, very quickly became cold tea if you didn't drink it. I mean, in a matter of minutes it was cold. In a few more minutes it would start to freeze over. This was at the height of the winter, so weather was very cold. But as I, going back to what I was saying, by April it was beginning to warm up again when we occupied this position in front of the battalion. And that is really where I had my swan song commanding 2 Platoon of A Company when we were attacked eventually one night. It had been rumoured that we were going to be attacked. The Canadian Brigade, in a similar position down the front, had had a probing attack a few nights before. And we heard that intelligence had intercepted messages suggesting that we were likely to be attacked. And the pattern would follow that of the Canadian attack, which was intermittent shelling during the day, building up around 6 or 7 in the evening with an intense bombardment, followed by an attack at about 9, 10 o'clock after dark. One night this pattern, or one day this pattern, appeared. We were being shelled during the day. One shell every 10 minutes, every quarter of an hour, and this gradually increasing in the afternoon. We got some heavy shelling, some fairly intense shelling, and we were all standing too ready to be attacked, and nothing happened. And that was that. So we thought maybe it was a false alarm. Then a couple of days later we were told that there were further intercepts and that this was still on, and that the signal for the attack would be one Very light fired in the direction the attack would take. And sure enough, the following day it started, and we had the artillery building up to the intensive bombardment, which the Sergeant Major that we had at the time, who had been in the Second World War, said was far more intense than anything he'd ever experienced in the Second World War. And then suddenly at 9 o'clock, the shelling stopped, there was a white Very light, and we were attacked. And under cover of the bombardment, the Chinese got right up to the bottom of the hill which we were on. So very quickly, of course, they were up onto our barbed wire. We used a very unpleasant form of defence, which I think is now illegal under whatever the current law is, of the phosphorus grenade, which The phosphorus grenade was designed as a quick method of producing a smoke screen, and in that you threw it, it exploded, and of course you get this intense white smoke. But we had discovered that it made a very effective weapon if thrown into barbed wire when troops are trying to struggle through it. Because once the attacking infantry are in the barbed wire, they can't move forward or back very fast. So if you throw white phosphorus grenades into it, they get the full force, of course, of the phosphorus, which will burn through anything. In that situation, we made very good use of it, because one has to remember that numbers were always against you. You were totally overwhelmed by the numbers of attackers in every case. So you had to rely on killing as many as you could before they overran you. We did, in fact, hold them off. They didn't, in fact, get into the company or the platoon position. We, in my platoon, don't know why, we always seemed to catch it, but we took the brunt of it on that particular occasion. But they didn't get through the wire, and eventually they withdrew. I say, that was my swan song. I was then summoned to battalion headquarters and told that I was to take over the machine gun platoon, which meant to me a life of total luxury. I was going to be just behind the battalion rather than just in front of it. I was going to have my own transport, because I had 12 jeeps and 6 medium machine guns, which was one of the specialist jobs in the battalion, and one which I was very pleased to have. It was also, I must admit, quite a nice rest to get away from commanding an absolutely basic infantry platoon after all that time. The machine guns, the way we tended to use them by this time, as a group of 6, they were a marvellous weapon. Initially, they'd been split down into sections of 2, and you'd have 2 machine guns with a company and so on, depending on the position you were in. We'd found the best way of using them was using them as a group of 6. But they had a maximum range of nearly 5,000 yards, 4,800 yards, which is quite a lot. And you could fire them indirectly, that is, you didn't have to see the target, because you had exactly the same sort of sighting arrangement on them as you had it on a field gun, a dial sight. And we used to fire every night into valleys opposite our positions, where one thought the Chinese might form up if they wanted to make an attack across the valley onto our lines. So we would plot on the map likely forming up places, and then intermittently during the night we would fire our guns into the area. And the what they call the cone of fire, that is the spread of the bullets landing on the ground at ranges of 4,000, 5,000 yards, is quite considerable. From one gun you get a spread of about probably up to 100 yards front to back and 30 yards wide. So you, with 6 guns carefully laid, you could cover quite a large area in one of these valleys firing your 6 guns. And this was our main task. Every night we'd be doing this. We were there, of course, to support the companies if they were attacked, because we were in such a position that we could fire across the front of the companies or down the sides of the companies, and also linking in with the battalions on either side of us. We could cover their fronts as well, as they could do the same for us.
Were the companies attacked whilst you were doing that job?
I don't remember any major attack of that sort while I was doing that. remained with them doing that then until we moved on a couple of occasions. But I remained with them and stayed with them until end of July when, well, 1st of August when we came out of the line for the last time. August the 1st being a very appropriate day because that was one of our battle honours, Minden Day, when we came out finally into reserve and handed over, in fact, to the Royal Fusiliers.
What was your opinion about the enemy in Korea?
The Chinese, who were our enemy, we really didn't see the Koreans. By the time we got there, the Korean army had ceased to exist effectively. The Chinese, at that time, were poorly equipped. They were totally fearless. You couldn't but respect them as an enemy. And they were a real threat. They had no air support. Latterly, they had good artillery support. Initially, they had virtually none. But it was extremely difficult to stop them. What drove them on? I don't know. But they came. They were fearless.
Did you ever capture any of them?
Occasionally, yes. Yes.
Under what circumstances?
Operation Commando, we captured a few. The hill we took then, when we took C Company's objective, we did take a few prisoners there. You didn't get many prisoners, but...
What did you make of them when you saw them close up?
They were typically what you would imagine as typically peasant Chinese stock. They were basically equipped. I mean, they wore baseball boots on their feet. In the winter, they wore padded cotton clothes, quilted padded cotton. In the summer, they wore sort of khaki cotton. The main weapon, of course, was the famous burp gun, which was a very, very basic submachine gun. They did have other weapons, which were, they were all basically of Russian origin, Russian design. I think some of them were Chinese manufacture, but they were certainly basic Russian design. They had no armour that we saw ever.
What was the demeanour of the prisoners?
Inscrutable, I suppose, would be the word. Yeah, exactly that. They were the famous Chinese inscrutable. Resignation.
Did it cause any trouble?
No. No.
How were they treated on capture?
Well, we just passed them back. So I honestly don't know.
Were any of your own men captured?
We had quite a lot captured. The major battle I haven't mentioned, funnily enough, because I wasn't actually involved in it. The battalion's major defensive battle was on November the 5th, 1951, which was when Speakman got his VC. We had one company, B Company, were overrun. Of which Speakman is part of B Company. And we lost a number of prisoners then and quite a lot missing. One of the platoon commanders was missing on that occasion. He must have been killed because he certainly wasn't a prisoner. I cannot remember the figures. of prisoners.
Don't worry about that.
No, but we did have a number taken prisoner.
Was there any fear of being taken prisoner?
I don't think there was at the time. I think if people had known what it meant, there might have been. Because, of course, prisoners weren't that well treated. There's a lot of literature to substantiate that, of course. But
for what were you awarded the MC?
That was for my swan song in April 52. Basically for commanding my platoon in that action. I like to say, I think with a bit of justification, that it was for that operation, but it was also a long service and good conduct medal on the part of the commanding officer, in that I had commanded a platoon right from the start. I'd had one or two tricky situations. I'd been wounded. I'd come back, and obviously he thought I'd done quite well on that particular occasion. And I think he added it all together and said, Jock's not a bad lad, really, and we'll give him a medal.
What was the trickiest situation you had in Korea?
The trickiest situation I had was very early on, actually, when I took a fighting patrol out. And, of course, I was fairly green, quite naturally. This was, I say, in the very early days, and we were on a particular position with a valley in front of us, and no sign of the Chinese on the other side of the valley. They had a habit of doing this, of staying well back and patrolling forward. And I was told to go down the valley, up the other side, take my platoon with me, and get onto the other side of the hills and see what I could see, see if I could see where the Chinese were. So, bright young platoon commander, first experience of war, off I went. Oh, jolly good show, you know, get away from the sitting on that hill and stretch my legs and go up that one. And off we went up to the top of this hill. All went fine. Platoon were all enjoying themselves, I think. Got onto the top of the hill on the other side. And suddenly somebody shot at us, which they weren't supposed to do at all. And we found, in fact, that it was fairly busy on the other side with the Chinese, mainly down in the valley. And, oh, that's right, we found a couple. They were obviously sort of early warning sentries on the top of the hill. And we chased them off. They left their light machine gun behind, which one of my characters took over. And he was firing this down into the village where the Chinese were. And, we had a bit of a party shooting him up and spotting, trying to see where more were, you know, because that's what we'd been sent for, after all. When we suddenly realised that we were in grave danger of getting cut off, but they were coming around behind us. We hadn't noticed this, you know, in our interest in what was going on in front of us, they were doing this. Anyway, I gave the word to get out of it, and we set off down a re-entrant, down back into the valley. Luckily, the Australians who were on our right had been watching all this going on, and they'd spotted some of these Chinese coming round, and their machine gun platoon, as I've just been talking about, opened up on this lot.